Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
And welcome to New Books in Literary Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. It is my great pleasure to talk today with Nicholas Boggs about the new edition of James Baldwin's Little Man, Little Man. Nicholas Boggs was an undergraduate at Yale when he discovered James Baldwin's out-of-print children's book for adults, Little Man, Little Man, A Story of Childhood, published in 1976. And he discovered this text at the Beinecke Rare Book and Manuscript Library. The senior thesis he wrote about it was published in the anthology James Baldwin Now. A subsequent essay on Little Man, Little Man that draws on his interviews in Paris with the book's illustrator, French artist Yoran Kazak, appears in the Cambridge Companion to James Baldwin, published in 2015. His research led him to co-edit and write the introduction to a new edition of Little Man, Little Man, published by Duke University Press this year, 2018, which the New York Times wrote, and I quote, couldn't be more timely, and Entertainment Weekly hailed as brilliant, essential. The recipient of fellowships from Yaddo, McDowell, and the Camargo Foundation, Nicholas Boggs is currently at work on a literary biography of Baldwin, forthcoming from Farrar, Straus, and Jewell. Nicholas, it is such a pleasure to have you with us today to talk about Little Man, Little Man. So thank you for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So in the kind of narrative that I just read about how this edition of the book came to be, we learned that you first encountered Little Man, Little Man at the Beinecke Rare Books Library at Yale. What drew you to the work? And what made you decide that this work needs to be made available to an audience of readers today?
Well, I was enrolled, this is in the mid-90s, I was taking what I believe was the first class at Yale ever devoted solely to the work of James Baldwin, and I knew that I wanted to write a senior thesis about him. I had read pretty much everything Baldwin had ever written because I had actually started reading him in high school at the public schools in Washington, D.C., and then in the class we read everything he wrote, and the professor, Maurice Wallace, mentioned that there was a children's book by Baldwin, and I'd never heard of it. So, I went to the Beinecke and was immediately sort of drawn into both the text itself aesthetically and also the story behind it. There was only a short paragraph in David Leeming's really wonderful biography about Baldwin concerning Yoran Kazak. So I emailed him and I asked him if he could put me in touch with him or had more information. And he told me, he wrote back and he said, I'm sorry, but I never met him and I think he's dead. And it wasn't until about 5 years later that I emailed some art historians in Paris just to see if perhaps I could get more information, leaving my phone number. And a few weeks later, a raspy French accented old man called me from Paris.
Wow, that's such an amazing story. Just thinking about the circulation of the text at once, you know, the text and the images, and it's kind of international geography between the United States and Paris. But one of the things I'm really interested, I mean, the thing that's most eye-catching, I think, is not only that Baldwin writes a children's book, but that it's an illustrated book. And so you write an introduction to this edition that just came out with Duke University Press. And you talk about Baldwin's framing of the book as, and I'm quoting here, a child's story for adults. What does this mean? And who is the book's imagined reader? So both at the time that Baldwin first published this child's story for adults in 1976, and also who's the imagined reader with this reprinting in 2018?
That's a terrific question, because it's one of many mysteries around this book, is just the question of genre. So in the edition that was published, there were two editions that were published in 1976, one by Dial Press, one by Michael Joseph, and one of them described it as a child's story for adults. Another one described it as a children's book for adults and an adult's book for children. In the typescript that you can find about it at the Schomburg, he writes a child's story, crosses that out, and then writes a children's story. So I think that, you know, it's sort of for us collectively now as readers to figure out what those designations mean. But I will say, in terms of the readership that he was imagining at publication, for sure he said that it was designed to address, quote, the self-esteem of Black children. So it was written for Black children and their families, but it was also dedicated to Buford Delaney, his mentor, the Black, you know, terrific Black painter who lived in Paris for many years, but was in Greenwich Village and met Baldwin when he was a teenager. At the time, Delaney was suffering from what they believe is the late stages of schizophrenia, and he was losing his memory. And so this book was in part supposed to sort of entertain Delaney. And it was Delaney who had introduced to Baldwin to Joran Kazak in Paris in the late 1950s. But of course, for anyone who's read or will read the foreword and afterword to this book, its origins really come from Baldwin's family. So Baldwin would, the transatlantic commuter, as he described himself, would go home often from the south of France or elsewhere in the world to see his family. He bought them a house on the Upper West Side. And his nephew, Tijan Karefa Smart, would often say, "Uncle Jimmy, Uncle Jimmy, when are you going to write a book about me?" And Jimmy would say, "Oh, I'm working on it." And then one day he actually did it. And it's one of the great pleasures of bringing this book back into print that we were able to have Tijan write the foreword to this book, and his sister Aisha Karefa Smart write the afterword. And she's actually the inspiration for the character of Blinky, and Tijan is TJ in the book. So there are very specific readers in mind, I think, when he wrote it. But there was also a much more general readership of Black children and their families. I think today there's been a lot of changes in terms of YA literature, children's literature, more diverse representation, obviously. So our hope, myself, along with my co-editor, Jennifer DeVere Brody of Stanford University, is that this can open up a conversation between parents and children and educators. But, you know, on a theoretical level, I guess, part of what we argue in our introduction is that he called it a children's story for adults because he wanted adults to look through sort of the vision of the children in the book, and Blinky in particular, who wears these kinds of special eyeglasses that really allow her to navigate the world around herself, but also sort of see the world in a way that looks askance at dominant representations of urban Black life.
So I want to come back to, you know, the story that you just recounted about, you know, about Tijan Karefa Smart kind of asking his Uncle Jimmy to write a story about him, and the way that, you know, these two narratives bookend the story, right? So his foreword and then Aisha Karefa Smart's afterword. There's something, and particularly in the way that you tell it, there's something really intimate about the way that this book came into the world as a request from family, as an act of love. So with that in mind, what was it like for you coming to this text, given the kind of intimacy of this familial context of its origins, which I think also opens up into a kind of intimacy of the community in the text's kind of bounded space of TJ's specific block in Harlem? So what was it like thinking about, you know, this conversation between family, these notions of community, and then your coming to the text in the way that you describe?
That's a great question. I mean, this has been, you know, the book was a collaboration itself between a painter, you know, a white French painter who had never been to Harlem, had never been to the United States, and, you know, internationally famous American, Black American writer. But also bringing it back into print has been a collaboration. I mean, not only did I track down Yoran Kazak and interview him, I met his wife, their son, who was Baldwin's godson, the other children of the Kazaks, close friends. They really welcomed me into their family in this long series of interviews. And then it was a friend who put me in touch with Aisha Karifa Smart. It was, and through her, I met her brother Tijan. And it was a really beautiful moment in September when the book was published. We had an event at the Schomburg, and we also had a little a sort of party where the Kazaks and Aisha and Tijan all got to meet each other. And it was sort of a wonderful culmination of really 2 decades of coordination, trying to get the book back into print. And what you sensed in the room and sort of the whole process of bringing it back into print was sort of the importance of love and kinship in Baldwin's life. You know, he was extremely close to his family, of course, but he was away from them a lot. And he did construct these alternative kinship structures in France, much of it in the south of France, but also earlier in Paris. And Yoran Kazak was part of that. Buford Delaney was part of that. And in a way, bringing this book back into print was a sort of appropriate way of sort of honoring Baldwin's life in its totality across you know, this transatlantic divide that he was often navigating throughout his life. So then it ended up representing his own childhood in Harlem. But in fact, Tijan and Aisha grew up on the Upper West Side. So it was combining the Upper West Side of their childhood with the Harlem of his childhood, but all imagined by a French painter living in Tuscany who had never been to Harlem, but was imagining it through conversations with Baldwin, reading Baldwin's writing, and photographs of Harlem and of Baldwin's family that Baldwin gave him. So it's a very unusual sort of book in the history of African American literature, in the history of children's literature, and certainly in Baldwin's corpus.
Right. So then that kind of expands our idea of community, right? So it's really fascinating to hear you describe the kind of community that was formed around this project of getting this book back in print, but also the sort of transnational nature of this community in terms of the spaces that the text imagines. And so just kind of in the story itself, so to think about what's happening in the story, we primarily see the world through TJ's eyes, right? So TJ is the main character, and he sees the adults in his neighborhood. And sometimes they acknowledge him, and at other times they act like they don't see him. And I found that really interesting and striking because it happens often enough, right, with different characters, with Mr. Man, with Miss Lee, that we begin to wonder what it means for a child to be seen. So can you tell us a little bit about how you see Baldwin working through these ideas of seeing and recognition in this story? What does it mean to be seen?
Well, that is a terrific question. I mean, I think for starters, from your question, beginning with you said, and I think it's correct, although it's complicated, that TJ was narrating it, but it's written in the third person, in kind of you know, free indirect discourse, which is an important part of the African American literary tradition. Of course, one thinks of Zora Neale Hurston's "Their Eyes Were Watching God," perhaps first and foremost. But I was always struck by that yes, it's TJ's consciousness, but it's written from the third person, so it's particular, but it's also trying to say something universal, I think, about a childhood in Harlem. And it's moving between, it does move between various sort of consciousness. It gets closer to Blinky's consciousness sometimes, but still in the third person, and then returns to TJ's. So that's one way that even who is speaking, before we get to who is seeing, mm-hmm. is sort of problematized or you know, I think to go back to kinship and community, it's a way of having a sort of individual sense of the children, but also a way of kind of marking their connection and how they were all sort of connected as speakers and even viewers. In terms of seeing in the text, again, I think Blinky is so important because she's wearing those eyeglasses. And she says at one point, or not, she doesn't say, but TJ says, he's skeptical of them because some white teachers at school bought them for her. And then when he puts them on, he can't see anything out of them. Mm-hmm. But I think the book, in many ways, as my co-editor Jennifer Brody put it, is a sort of a primer for how to view the world differently. And in fact, one of the many interesting things about the book is that it's really Blinky as the older sort of sister figure who is teaching the young boys how to navigate Harlem and also how to see the world in the way that she does. And so at first, TJ says, you know, he doesn't understand the glasses, but as the text progresses, he starts to describe the skin color of the children in all of these kinds of diverse ways. So sometimes it's like coffee early in the morning, other times it's like honey. So the TJ, but also the reader, is learning to kind of see outside of these binary models of black, white, and that within blackness, the category of blackness, there's all in black childhood, there are all these various colors that are seen and experienced. So that's to be seen is to be seen in this book, I think, a full spectrum rather than the reductive binary that you would get in some of the early, say, racist children's literature, right? Mm-hmm. Or the images. It's interesting. One of the texts that Baldwin gave to Joran Kozak was the Black Book, edited by Toni Morrison, which sort of a compendium in history of representations of African Americans, you know, and including Sambo images and stuff like that. So I think this book is sort of engaging and combating those kinds of stereotypes. And I could say much more about Blinky, who in many ways, you know, there's this beautiful image of her in the middle of the book, all orange with her eyeglasses blinking, and her face is only sort of partially painted. And I asked Joran Kozak, he did that a lot in these images. The children's faces were partially painted. And I said, why? And he said, well, that he and Baldwin always talked about, quote, that like in the full light, no one is fully black or fully white.
That's really deep. because I'm really fascinated and struck by what you're saying here about what it means to see differently, what it means to see a spectrum, what it means to see nuance. And as I was reading, I realized that I think lost my child's imagination because I don't really know how to read an illustrated book anymore. So I'm really glad that you gestured to, you know, Kaza's discussion of what he was doing with the illustrations, because I was curious to know what you see to be the role of his illustrations. So are they retelling the story of the text, but visually? Are they asking us to read and to see the text in a particular way? What do you make of the role of the illustrations in this text?
Well, I think it's significant that originally Baldwin hoped that Buford Delaney would illustrate the book, but because his illness was proceeding so quickly, he sort of landed on Joran Kozak as the next best thing because they had a very similar aesthetic. They both were moving between figurative work and abstraction at different times in their careers. And Joran Kozak, I mean, sorry, Buford Delaney had said that one of the reasons he moved to Paris was that you can't be an abstract black painter in America, especially at that moment. So I think with Joran's illustrations, it was sort of the legacy of Buford Delaney that he was trying to tap into. And I think, I mean, there's a whole, so I went to many, many years ago, I went to Tuscany where Joran's wife was living, and she had kept all the original illustrations from the book. And there was an entire version of the book written in crayon, or drawn in crayon, excuse me, first, which are sort of beautiful, but he ultimately decided that he needed, that they weren't, it wasn't close enough, I don't think, to Buford Delaney's aesthetic, and he wanted to turn to pencil and watercolor. in his words, to imagine the unimaginable. And this was sort of a favorite phrase of Yoran Kazak's. And he needed to do that because, you know, he had never been to Harlem. And he had to sort of imagine it, as I said, through what Baldwin was telling him. So the illustrations, I think, there's so many different ways to interpret it, and it's important that that people come to this text and see what they need to see and what they do see. But for me, I definitely see it as a version of seeing through. It's like you're putting on Blinky's eyeglasses. And here I have to credit the critic Margot Natalie Crawford, who has written a wonderful unpublished piece that explained a lot to me about how the importance of the visual in the book. She was the first one who said and wrote, it's like you're putting on Blinky's eyeglasses where everything looks like it was rained on. And this is, again, I'm paraphrasing her. She said that the book helps us how did she put it? It was a beautiful turn of phrase. I'm not going to catch it correct, but to see past the realism of race, the quote unquote realism of race, into the dreaminess of what might be. Mm. And to me, that's sort of imagining the unimaginable. It's imagining a vision of Harlem life and Black children's life in Harlem that the dominant narratives don't give. And it's both figurative because it is representational of these children, but it's also abstract. It's allowing for a more abstract and imaginative version of Black childhood. And it's hard, you know, in the recent, I think of things like Random Acts of Fly Nest recently, or Sorry to Bother You, or just a turn towards some Afro-surrealism. Mm-hmm. This isn't exactly that, but I think there's a similar yearning for an imaginative space for Black creativity outside of like the traditional boundaries.
Right, and I think that kind of playing with the genres and thinking about what it means to capture this imaginative space also allows for a kind of more complex rendering of Black experiences, of Black childhood, you know, like you're saying, beyond the sort of realism and sort of stark Black and white binaries. So you've evoked Blinky's eyeglasses quite a bit, and I was wondering who your favorite character in the text was, if you have one.
Well, it changes. Okay. It always was Blinky, of course, as I've said. But of course, after I met Tijan, you know, it was Tijan for a while there. And then something remarkable happened when the book came out. My co-editor and I did a reading at McNally Jackson in Williamsburg, and somehow she got the actress Joa Li to read from the book. And she read she didn't read little snippets. She read almost like the last third of the book. And there's one character in the book that I actually often found problematic. And that was Miss Li. And she is the wife or girlfriend of the superintendent. And she turns out that she's an alcoholic, and she was on the top of the building and she dropped her liquor bottle by mistake. And the big drama in the book is that one of the children steps on it and cuts his foot and ends up, into the underground, which is sort of a trope in African-American literature where he's healed by the other children and by Mr. Man and Miss Li. But it seemed to me that this representation of Miss Li kind of was the only point in the book where it seemed to kind of almost affirm or play into some sort of stereotypical representations of urban Black life and womanhood in particular. And I was always sort of troubled by that, but there was something about when Joa read from it. And again, this is where the free and direct discourse, I think, is important, because it was sort of moving between closer to the consciousness of various characters, including, I realized, Miss Li. And I was able to see that this was actually a complex rendering of this character coming to grips with her addiction and her relationship with her husband, and and then actually trying to sort of work through it and heal the young child, WT, who cut his foot. And there was something about hearing her read from it that suddenly made Miss Lee my favorite character, kind of a heroic figure, and see her in a way that I hadn't seen her before. And that is one of the really exciting things about getting the book republished and getting it out in the world, is to talk about it with people, but also to hear Aisha and Tijan read from it, and to hear other folks read from the book. It's meant to be read. I mean, it comes alive. It's the Black vernacular voice that was so important to Baldwin. So I guess it keeps changing the characters who are my favorite.
So that reading sounds amazing, and I'm particularly interested in what it means to, like you're saying, have this book read aloud, and to think about sort of the oral landscape of the book, because music is really prominent throughout the text. We have lots of the illustrations that are like full page illustrations with musical notes. We have Mr. Mann, who has this sort of record that's playing all the time, and I'm wondering what you make of music specifically, but of sound more generally in this story, particularly given what you just shared about how our experience of the text changes when it's read aloud.
That's a great question. And I think there's a really smart graduate student, and I forget his name, but he was at the Schomburg event and we spoke later, and he had some really smart questions, especially about music and sound in the book, because I think if that's something that has not been explored enough and we didn't pay enough attention to, given the constraints in our introduction, and I really hope that he and others will write more about it. Because you're absolutely right, it begins a music. The opening line is about how music is all up and down the street, and you see these music notes sort of floating in the air above the Harlem streetscape. And throughout the book, music is referenced in really interesting ways. Mr. Mann, as you said, is playing the record player. There's a point about halfway through the book where the children are listening to Night Train, I believe it is, and doing their African strut. And there's an African scene sort of bursting out of their imagination, out of the side of the building. And in boldface, it says, TJ moving in a jungle where he can't get no satisfaction. So it's kind of also referencing the Rolling Stones and sort of the history, I think, of white appropriation of Black cultural forms. So I think it does have a very complicated relationship to music. And another thing that this graduate student pointed out to me, he went and looked at the box, Little Man box in the Schomburg. And I believe in an earlier version, it ends, you know, in a different way. It ends with Ray Charles, a song from Ray Charles specifically is what enables sort of at the end of the book for Miss Lee, Mr. Mann, and the children to all come out of this kind of sadness and shock around the foot injury, and kind of construct a different kind of family, I think, and kinship among them that is enabled by Ray Charles in the draft. And in the book, it's enabled by this African strut that TJ does and that Blinky does. So it really is music, dance, that's sort of linked specifically to Black cultural forms that has this kind of healing impact on the characters and on the community at the end of the book.
So I think that thus far in our conversation, you've been situating or identifying also ways that this book is working through sort of central elements and themes in African American literature as a genre. And I'm interested in that because I think that a lot has been made about how different this book is from the rest of Baldwin's oeuvre, you know, particularly because it's sort of billed as a children's book. But do you see any resonances or connections across his oeuvre in a way that includes this book? And I'm asking that because I'm curious to know, what does including this book in his broader work do for our understanding of Baldwin as a writer?
Wow, that's another terrific question. I think this book definitely obviously stretches back to his nonfiction about growing up in Harlem, Notes of a Native Son, you know, many other essays where he writes about Harlem. And of course it relates to Go Tell It on the Mountain. But I would really place it in this sort of interesting moment in the 70s, and I would include If Beale Street Could Talk in this, where Baldwin was living in the south of France, but beginning to kind of experiment in ways formally, I think. He was sort of thematically, he was rerooting himself in Black life in Harlem and in the Black family specifically. But formally, he was starting to approach it in more innovative ways, I think, that actually turned off a lot of critics at the time. I mean, If Beale Street Could Talk was a bestseller, but with the exception of Joyce Carol Oates, it was not well received critically. Little Man, of course, was almost totally ignored. But in Little Man, you see this, you know, this genre bending. But in If Beale Street Could Talk, you see gender bending. So the novel is narrated for the first time by Baldwin from the perspective, first person perspective of a woman, a pregnant Black woman, Tish. And he was really exploring gender identity and really along with race in really interesting ways that we see in his essay, Freaks and the American Ideal of Manhood, published a little bit later. But he was really working through his own gender identity and the question of sort of gender in America, period, as it intersects with race. So I think I see this as connect as Little Man specifically connecting to his entire, to all of his work. But specifically, I think it's part of a period in his life that just now scholars like Magdalena Zaborowska and others are really starting to see as aesthetically and politically daring. And it's just a wonderful, I mean, the movie hasn't come out yet, but I'm excited to see the film. And I'm excited about like Zaborowska's recent book, Me and My House, mm-hmm. is brilliant. And it really it pays a lot of attention to the latter stages of his career, which are still under theorized and under thought, because there's this dominant narrative that after the 60s, he was in decline, which seems to me a premature announcement.
Right. So I think that Magdalena Zaborowska is also, it's my understanding that she's also working on a kind of a reconstruction of a digital reconstruction of Baldwin's house, just because it's been, at least part of it has been kind of demolished for a development that's happening.
Yes, very sadly. Yeah.
That is such devastating news. But I'm really fascinated because, you know, you're pointing to a lot of the maybe resurgence is not the right word, but there's a lot of momentum, right, in a conversation about Baldwin that's happening currently. And in your bio that I shared with our listeners at the beginning of this conversation, you know, I ended by mentioning that you're currently working on a literary biography of Baldwin that's forthcoming. Would you mind telling us just a little bit about how you situate that work in this broader conversation that's happening currently about Baldwin?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. And I do see Magdalena's work as being so inspiring and important. And my own work would not be possible without hers, or without the truly groundbreaking work of Baldwin's premier biographer, David Leeming, who was his personal secretary. His 1994 biography was just incredible in that it captured the totality of Baldwin's life in a way that we haven't seen since. And Magdalena has brought incredible sort of scholarly and theoretical rigor to bear on Baldwin's later work and to safeguarding his legacy, and specifically a lot of the belongings that were some lost and some retained in the south of France. And she, I think, sort of led the charge of many scholars and Baldwin fans who have made pilgrimages to his home, including myself. I jumped over the back of the wall and got to see the view from there many years ago. But it's a very sad situation, because Baldwin wanted that space to become an artist residency. Artist residencies in the States were very important to him, places like McDowell and Yaddo. And those are some of the only places he's able to write in the States. Otherwise, he had to sort of escape to Europe, to Istanbul, and to St. Paul de Vence. But I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought on this one.
Oh, no worries. I guess I was just asking sort of how you situate your forthcoming literary biography of Baldwin.
Oh, great. Yes, absolutely. So my forthcoming literary biography is a biography of relationships in Baldwin's life. So it tells his whole life story, but it does so through his relationships with Buford Delaney, Lucian Happersberger, and Yoran Kazak. And it attempts to understand, in particular, like how his later life was not a story solely of tragedy, but one of survival and triumph. I mean, one of the things that I think is so amazing about his life is how he was able to navigate this intense political moment, or really lifetime, in his involvement in the civil rights movement, and continued to produce important, or truly important, and ever-changing works of art. So, with the with my own interviews, and also with the new Schomburg papers that are available, James Baldwin papers, thanks to the archivist Stephen Fullwood and others, we have an opportunity to reassess Baldwin's place in American history and life at a really pivotal moment, obviously, for when we're still learning from him. And so we need to really understand him in his totality and in his complexity, so that his words and his legacy can help us navigate our way out of a really difficult time in America and globally.
I really appreciate your gesture to the necessity to seeing the totality of Baldwin. Being a Francophone scholar myself, I focus mostly on Baldwin's writings about France. And so having the opportunity to read Little Man, just kind of gives me a much broader sense of just the scope of Baldwin's thinking and his literary work. So I'm very much looking forward to your literary biography that I think will add much to the ongoing conversation about what it means to see Baldwin in his totality. So I've been talking with Nicholas Boggs about the new edition of James Baldwin's Little Man, that just came out in 2018 with Duke University Press. Nicholas, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a true pleasure.